Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, how about this? A lot more places opened this week where some Florida residents can get their COVID-19 vaccine. Publix took reservations for all 730 of its in-store pharmacies statewide. More Winn-Dixie and Harvey's stores are doling out doses. And other pharmacies have been added to the list, even as the number of people getting their shots over the last week has actually dropped, Tom, compared to last week.
Yeah, Governor Ron DeSantis hopscotched around the state this week, announcing new vaccine sites on Tuesday in Hialeah here in South Florida. While announcing more pharmacies would be giving vaccine shots, he added that more people may soon be eligible to get vaccinated at FEMA vaccination sites that will open next week in four locations, including Jacksonville, Orlando, and Tampa.
When these federal sites, so we're going to get a federally supported site in Miami-Dade. We think it's going to happen next week. We want that for 65 and up, but we also want that to be open. Any sworn law enforcement teacher, I think, will start age 50 or above.
It was the first time we heard about additional eligibility from the governor. The sites that the governor was talking about are the federally run sites that the Federal Emergency Management Agency is expected to open on Wednesday next week.
And in Jacksonville on Thursday, DeSantis made this prediction.
Without question, barring any problems with the vaccine distribution, you're going to see the age lower at some time in March, for sure.
Good news, but here's the thing. Specifics are still missing. A new analysis of state vaccine plans finds that Florida is the only state in the nation that hasn't let us all know who will be next in line to get a vaccine. Now, although more than a million seniors have received both doses here in Florida, the state's plans have left out healthcare workers and younger residents with underlying medical conditions that make them more vulnerable. Also this week, the data science firm Cogitativo released a report that found Florida's lack of a future vaccine distribution roadmap could leave the Sunshine State vulnerable to, in their words, complete chaos. We'll have more about those findings in a few minutes, but right now we want to hear from you, Florida. Are you eligible for a vaccine? Maybe still waiting? Who do you think should be next in line to get the shot? Call us up wherever you are in the state, 305-995-1800 to join the Florida Roundup, or tweet us at Florida Roundup.
Dr. Jason Goldman is back with us here on the Florida Roundup, a physician in South Florida, American College of Physicians liaison to the Centers for Disease Control Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. This is the group that came up with the original recommendations of who should get the shot and when, or shots as the case may be. Dr. Goldman, welcome back to the Roundup. Nice to have you again.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be with you.
Tell us the scientific recommendation for who should be next in line to receive COVID-19 vaccinations.
Well, the guidelines have never really changed. The initial phasing was based on ethical considerations, fairness, justice, to make sure that those most at need, not just at risk for getting the disease and dying from it, but those at most at risk for transmitting, balance with those who are essential to the functions of society, as well as making sure that we had equity and eliminated healthcare disparities. So those guidelines really haven't changed. It was healthcare workers, those over 75, and those in long-term care facilities. And then when we went to 1B, it was those over 75, as well as those who were on the front line and essential workers. It was never meant to be an age-based approach, because an age-based approach in and of itself doesn't solve the ethics and the fairness, especially when you consider that minorities and people of color, many of them may not reach age 65 because of the healthcare disparities, yet they're on the front lines, and we've seen a disproportionate number of them fall prey to this illness. So an age-based approach is not really where it was intended to go. We really needed to give the vaccine to those most at risk of getting the disease who could not protect themselves through other means.
So, Dr. Goldman, Florida did not follow those recommendations, which came out in early December and then were amended to some degree in mid-December. You spoke about these recommendations being grounded in fairness, justice, and equity. Because Florida has really followed an age-based eligibility, although it does have healthcare workers, long-term care residents, and those with certain underlying medical conditions that present more vulnerability to COVID-19 should the virus present in those patients. With the Florida strategy being really focused on age-based 65 plus, is that unfair, unjust, and inequitable?
In some ways, yes, it is. Because what it is not doing is giving it to those who may be most at risk for getting the disease. Certainly, we know that the elderly population is more at risk for dying, but they may be able to protect themselves through other means as opposed to someone who's on the front lines and cannot get to protect themselves through other means. Someone who has to go to work, has to be in the public, has to be exposed to people may need the vaccine more than someone who can isolate and quarantine.
Has Florida's age-based strategy added to health inequities?
In some ways it has. As I said, you know, many people in minorities and people of color won't get to age 65. You know, we've found through the American College of Physicians studies that one of the biggest determinants of life expectancy was your zip code. So we know that if you are not living in the right zip code, you may not live as long. So we really need to target those who are most at risk for getting the disease as well as balance the necessary functions of society.
The Centers for Disease Control is not recommending vaccinations open up for anyone under 65, except for those with underlying risks or essential workers. For people not in those groups, Dr. Goldman, when might they expect to be eligible?
That really depends on the manufacturers and when we can get enough vaccines. I mean, the bottom line is every single person needs the vaccine. We just don't have enough supply. Once the supply is high enough, then everyone will get the vaccine and we won't have to have discussions of this nature because we'll have enough resources. So it really depends on all the manufacturers getting those vaccines out.
To the supply question, the initial recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control advisory panel, of which you are an advisor, took into account vaccine supply. The FDA is considering emergency authorization use for the one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We may hear from the FDA as early as today on this Friday or over the weekend. There are additional vaccines that are still in clinical trials. Governor Ron DeSantis this week said that he expects a lot more supply in a month. Take a listen.
What I think will happen is because of the increase in Pfizer, because Johnson & Johnson will start getting produced more. I even think you'll see more Moderna. As we get into April, this thing is not going to be very difficult for people to be able to get. I think the supply is going to be very robust.
You agree with that forecast, that prediction, Dr. Goldman?
Well, we are hopeful that the supply will be robust. It, again, really depends on the manufacturers and if there's enough supply. And what I am hopeful about with the single dose refrigerated shot is that it will be able to be given at more places, such as physician offices. We'll be able to set up greater vaccine centers and vaccine distribution just by the nature of the J&J vaccine being able to be refrigerated and more easily administered.
We'll take some phone calls with Dr. Goldman in a moment. I want to ask you, Dr. Goldman, the data from the Department of Health, when you look at the number of first doses given week to week and the number of second doses or treatments completed week to week, it continues to drop. And we've heard from the state, we heard last week during this hour on this program that they were expecting more supply this week. How do you explain if that supply is coming through, and put that aside for a moment, but assume that to be true, how do you explain fewer Floridians week over week getting first doses and second doses?
Well, the biggest concern I have is vaccine hesitancy. I hear it from patients in the community and people feeling that it was rushed or that there may be problems with it. It was not rushed. The data, the safety, the efficacy of the technology has been around for decades. So I think the biggest thing we have to overcome, number one, is vaccine hesitancy. Number two, really stress to people that you may have reaction to the first shot, fever, chills, body aches, headaches, but this is normal and expected. So do not be afraid of getting that second shot. The concern is they get the first shot, they don't feel well, they forestall the second one. So I just really want to encourage people to understand it is safe, it is effective, and if you're able to get the vaccine, you should get it.
So, for instance, in the past 7 days, fewer than 200,000 Floridians got first dose shots, according to the Department of Health data. The previous 7 days had almost 300,000, so a drop by 30%. Is that vaccine hesitancy playing out, do you think?
I think that may contribute to it, and or that people weren't able to get it, or there were scheduling difficulties, or just the way in which they were needed to get the vaccine and get on the list may have caused some issues or problems, especially for the elderly population, not being able to do the internet or other scheduling mechanisms. So it is concerning that there is a drop, as well as the very real existence of vaccine waste at the end of the day when they have extra doses available for no one to give it to.
Another important issue. Dr. Jason Goldman is going to stick with us for several more minutes. He is with the American College of Physicians, the liaison to the Centers for Disease Control Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. He's a physician in South Florida. Your phone calls coming up at 305-995-1800.
And your tweets, lots of people letting us know what they think on Twitter. Here's just one from a listener. He says, all teachers and the medically vulnerable should be next in line. Joyce is calling in from Pompano Beach. Hi, Joyce. You're on the Florida Roundup.
Hi, how are you guys?
Oh, I'm great, thanks. Good to hear your voice. What are your thoughts?
I would just like to know when, you know.
Yeah.
I had a viral infection a few years ago, and I have a pacemaker, but I'm only 38 years old. I think it's really important to get vaccinated. I'd like to find out when it would open up for somebody in my group.
Sure. And totally understand that, Joyce. Certainly you're not alone. Thanks for sharing your story with us. And as we expand on that, let's go now to Cindy Prinz, PhD. She's on the line. Dr. Prinz is an infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Florida. Dr. Prinz, good to have you back on the show. Actually, we need to unmute Dr. Prinz. And as we work to do that, it's 305-995-1800. We're talking about criticism of Florida not providing a clear vaccination roadmap, letting people know who's next in line. Now, a moment ago, we heard Tom talking about a Kaiser analysis about this. Do we have Dr. Prinz on the air? Dr. Prinz, can you hear me all right?
Hi, I can hear you. Thank you for having me.
So good to have you. And thanks for rolling along with us here, everybody, as we connect everyone at a distance. Dr. Prinz, let me ask you about this. In addition to that Kaiser report, a data science firm this week called Cohetativo, they released numbers criticizing Florida's lack of a detailed roadmap for who's next in line. They found that if the state would just implement a plan with clinical data, and I'm quoting here, that provides a clear view of the prevalence of health conditions like obesity, diabetes, and hypertension, that the state could save nearly 100,000 lives and avoid more than 840,000 hospitalizations. If you could unmute yourself there, I'd love to get your response to this criticism of the lack of information that Florida residents are getting about when they might be eligible to get a shot. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a big concern. I happen to be at a vaccine clinic right now, and that's probably one of the most frequent questions I get asked is when am I going to get a shot? Where am I in line? And, you know, I don't know that we need a fully detailed plan from A to Z of every single person, but it would be really nice to have a plan that at least included who the next priority groups are going to be, that detailed some of these conditions that are going to be high priority, even for people who are of younger age, and just to let people know, when can they expect to get their vaccine?
Sure. Just as a point of comparison, in a neighboring state, Georgia has announced that teachers, school staffers will join the vaccine pool in early March. It's that kind of specific information, I think, that people are hankering for. Now, once the vaccine supply gets more broad, for example, the new Johnson & Johnson vaccine could be approved as soon as today. You've been arguing for a while now that our goal for vaccinations should be broader than just flattening the curve, right? You want to see transmission curb to a point where the virus just stops circulating at all. When do you think we might get there?
Well, I do think it'll be a while before we get there. I mean, we have to remember that our younger populations, we don't have an approved vaccine for them yet, for those who are under 16 years of age. So obviously they are starting to do those clinical trials now, but it's going to be some time before they have that data and they have approval for those younger age groups. In the meantime, I think what we're looking for is the folks who are getting vaccinated now. That's fantastic. We're going to have some people who are going to be a little more hesitant, and hopefully they'll see people getting vaccinated and then they'll start to decide that, hey, you know what, I am going to do that. And then finally, we'll have our last group. We may have some people who decide never to get vaccinated, but you know, if we can get a high enough proportion of the population to take the vaccine, then it is really my hope that eventually we can get to a point of not having transmission. But I think we're probably looking at, you know, a year down the line before we hit that point.
Some ways ahead. We're speaking with Dr. Cindy Prinz, infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Florida. What are your questions about who might be next in line to get vaccinated here in the state? 305-995-1800. Philippe in Orlando. Hi, Philippe. Happy Friday. Go ahead.
How are you?
All right. How are you? Go ahead.
I'm doing good. Hey, I'm a little concerned because I'm 61. I've had two heart attacks, one stroke. I take two insulins for my diabetes. I have gone on the Orange County site to try to get an appointment, and it does ask you what your underlying conditions are. But then as soon as you put your birthday in, it knocks you right out. It says, okay, bye-bye.
Yeah.
We'll put you on standby. And, you know, we're lost. There's like no system. I'm hearing of vaccines that are being lost. People are not showing up for appointments. You know, maybe they can come up with something. Like somebody can be like in my condition, or the caller before me, that can be on a standby.
Sure.
Where we can receive a call and run right to it and get the vaccine that somebody refused.
And I'm sure you can't wait. Thank you, Philippe. And Cindy Prinz, that's what this data science analysis is criticizing in Florida, that there isn't an allowance made for callers like Philippe who might have a condition like diabetes. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. I mean, the idea in vaccinating the older population is that they're vulnerable, but, you know, these are also people who are vulnerable, who are younger and have some of these underlying conditions that, you know, we have data that shows that they are at risk of poor outcomes from COVID-19. And, you know, at the very least, you don't want to see someone get kicked out of the system. There's sort of a stage of registering in the system where someone is able to put in their information and get in line. And then, you know, the next stage after that is to get them an appointment when that time comes. So, you know, ideally, I think people should at least be able to get into the system, logged in with those underlying conditions, and then we're ready to get them in appointments and vaccinated when that time comes. But I would like to see that come sooner rather than later.
Sure. And, you know, there's still so much to get into as we continue this discussion. The COVID variants that are moving around the state, particularly in South Florida, you know, finding out if vaccination protects you from transmission. There are so many questions we still have for you. So Dr. Cindy Prinz with us from UF, can you stick with us a few minutes longer as we continue the discussion? That would be great. And we're continuing to get tweets here on the Florida Roundup. Here's one from Kathleen. My family member who is elderly still hasn't been able to get the vaccine. Lots of feedback coming into the show. Get on the line now. 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. As we talk about the vaccination rollout this Friday, we'll be right back. This is Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We're talking about the vaccination distribution here in Florida. Jennifer sends us this tweet to @FloridaRoundup. I'm a postal worker, hoping I'll be on the list to get vaccinated soon. Jill sends us this note. Age-based plus health workers is the most fair and effective at limiting the overwhelming of hospitals and health workers. I'm 62 and will gladly sign up for any available vaccine in March. She adds, our governor is doing a great job. Other states are following our example. 305-995-1800, the phone number here on the Florida Roundup, or at Florida Roundup on Twitter. You can continue our conversation here with Dr. Cindy Prinz, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Florida, and Dr. Jason Goldman, a physician in South Florida and with the American College of Physicians liaison to the Centers for Disease Control Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. To Jill's tweet, Dr. Goldman, other states following Florida's early example on targeting 65 plus. My personal experience having family and loved ones in that age group in the Midwest, some Midwestern states didn't go age-based first, and some elderly relatives have had to wait quite some time. So while Florida has been kind of at the forefront of this age base, not all states, however, have followed suit. What are the differences that have existed?
Well, that's correct. Every state, every governor has the authority to run the jurisdiction the way they see fit and come up with their own guidelines. CDC merely is doing recommendations. Whether they followed or not is up to the individual jurisdiction based on the needs of that state. You know, there is a balance that we try to achieve with the recommendations between age, essential function, equity, as well as those most in need, which is why you see in phase 1A was healthcare workers as well as long-term care facilities. Phase 1B had 75 and up as well as the frontline essential workers. When you got to 1C and it went up to 65 and above. Right. So there was a balance between the two, and it was not all or none.
Dr. Prinz, the central question here, and you rhetorically asked this earlier, who is the next high priority group in Florida?
Yeah, that is the important question. And I think we have a few high priority groups that we need to think about. So, you know, certainly we want to think about those who have underlying conditions and get them covered because they are also at high risk of, as I said, of hospitalization and of poor outcomes. I think we also need to think about those who are at higher risk settings of transmission. So thinking about certainly some of the frontline workers like emergency responders. I also want to point out that we have a lot of folks working in our food industry, and in particular, some of our migrant workers who also are at high risk because of conditions where they work. So, you know, we need to think about those populations and, you know, what's happening with them, and can we get them covered as well so that they're not also being put at risk of poor outcomes.
We are talking with two experts this Friday on the Florida Roundup about the state's vaccination roadmap. Actually, it's been criticized for we don't have enough of a roadmap as to who might be next in line to get the vaccine. 305-995-1800 to call in, share your thoughts with us. Lots of tweets coming into the show about this, too. Here's one from Zach. I think it's time to drop the age-based rollout and go toward a sector-based one like other states. Frontline workers should be top priority, he says. We have another doctor on the line, too, Dr. Bauer in Destin. Hi, Dr. Bauer.
Hi there.
Hey, what are your thoughts about how we can expedite vaccinations in the Sunshine State?
So as a physician, I'm trying to get my patients who are at risk get immunized, and I agree that age and health, you know, just age is not enough. It's an oversimplification. For example, I have a 51-year-old who was recently diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He's starting chemotherapy. I need him to get immunized. As he gets the chemotherapy, and his immune system is going to be lowered. But, you know, I'm just not able to do that because he's not 65 yet. So what I think is, we need to have a way that's more equitable, you know, an app, for example, that asks questions. Are you diabetic? Are you immunocompromised? Do you have cancer? And then that app would then send the data to a physician who would then certify those medical conditions. Once that's certified, the app would generate a score between 0 to 100. And so then people who are between 90 to 100 are told, okay, you know, everybody who has this score on their app, you know, show up and get your immunization. So I think I need to make this app.
Hey, you might be onto something there. Dr. Bauer, that's a pretty innovative solution. You know, Tom, no shortage of medical experts out there. We have a really smart audience, don't we? We're trying to nudge the state along. And, you know, it's interesting, although, you know, there are successes with this vaccination rollout, there's a lot of pressure on the DeSantis administration over his priorities, as we're hearing from our guests and our callers today.
A lot of focus on the part of Floridians, a lot of focus on the part of medical professionals, and of course, a lot of focus nationally on what Florida has done and hasn't done, both in terms of reopening the economy so many months ago, and now, of course, with the distribution of the vaccine and the strategy that Governor DeSantis and the state has taken. A number of folks have brought up this idea of underlying conditions. And Dr. Goldman, I want to ask you about underlying conditions here. We have one tweet here from Percy who writes, "I'm sorry, anyone who says that Florida's governor is doing a great job at vaccines is living in an alternate universe. My daughter has lupus and can't get anything because she's only 43 years old." Percy writes, "This is a ridiculous claim. People with underlying conditions are screwed." Now, the reason why I ask about underlying conditions is it's been brought up a couple of times here. And in the governor's original executive order, which has been the guidelines that the state has used for vaccine distribution, there were long-term care facility residents, people 65 and older, healthcare professionals with direct patient contact. And then there was a line, Dr. Goldman, that said at the end, hospital providers may also vaccinate persons who they deem to be extremely vulnerable to COVID-19. Is that where the underlying conditions exception comes in?
Well, I mean, one could make that argument. There are a lot of potential underlying conditions, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, immunocompromised conditions that put them more at risk for death from COVID-19. So could that be an exception? Perhaps, but it needs to be a more coordinated effort and not this Hunger Games style version of vaccination, of trying to get it whenever you can. We do need a more equitable rollout and plan so that everyone gets the vaccine, because at the end of the day, we all need to be vaccinated.
Mm. Hearing that that word equitable a lot in this discussion, let us know what you think, Florida. 305-995-1800. Rich is on the line from Jensen Beach. Hey, Rich. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. So my concern is I'm a retired firefighter, and I have a daughter who's a nurse in New York City. Florida is unlikely to ever reach herd immunity. That drop-off you've seen lately in the number of people vaccinated is people in Florida are simply not going to get vaccinated. They had a president who told them not to get vaccinated. They have a governance they no longer trust. 30% or 40% of Floridians will probably never take the vaccine. So my question is, herd immunity for them by getting sick, herd immunity never, and this continues to be a chronic illness as it mutates? It's very unlikely Floridians vaccinate en masse.
Well, I hope you're wrong, Rich, but I want to put the question to Dr. Prinz. What about that, doctor, particularly in light of the fact that there are new and more contagious variants spreading across the state. 100 cases of a variant in Broward County alone. So how do we reach herd immunity given all of these challenges?
Yeah, I can emphasize with what Rich is saying, you know, a concern that, you know, maybe we won't have full uptake on the vaccine, but I am still hopeful that we'll get more than 80% vaccinated at this point. That remains to be seen what will happen. The variants are a concern. Right now, the variant that is most widely circulating in Florida is the B117 variant, or what people refer to as the UK variant. And that variant, we know that these vaccines are effective against it. So the main concern there is just the level of transmission within our communities and trying to get people vaccinated before we see more widespread transmission of that. But there are other variants that the vaccines are not necessarily as effective against. They'll still be protective for people, but you know, we may still have some issues with transmission with those variants. So, you know, a concern again is just we need to get everyone covered with vaccine while we can. We need to get everyone to continue to take precautions not to transmit these variants around while they're waiting to get vaccinated. And then the other part of it is we don't want COVID to continue to circulate, because you get new variants that get created while that happens.
Dr. Goldman?
Yeah, so two quick points. Number one, we have data to show that the vaccine will prevent you from getting seriously ill. We do not necessarily have the data to show it interrupts disease transmission, number one. Number two, natural immunity, we do not know how long that lasts. So people depending on herd immunity through infection, we do not know if that will be effective long term. Plus, the longer we wait to get people vaccinated, the more variants that are generated, and we do not know if this will interrupt disease transmission. So everyone needs to get vaccinated as fast as possible so that they don't get sick themselves and end up in the hospital, which is what the data shows us currently, although we are looking to see if the data will long-term show interruption of disease transmission.
Lasad in Sarasota calling the Florida Roundup. Hi, Lasad. Go ahead. What are your thoughts?
Hi. My question is, I don't hear any about my idea, is that The virus is spreading out there, and we're not using the vaccine to stop the virus. I understand that the healthcare workers are the first exposed, which is great that they are all getting vaccinated now. And I would love to see the government take advantage of the database of all the people who are infected, and we can use the contact tracing to give priority to people who are have been exposed to the virus. And that's the best way, using the vaccine to stop the spread and protect those people who have been exposed, you know, to the virus.
Thank you for that, Lasad. Okay, Dr. Prinz, I've heard contact tracing has not really rolled out very well in Florida. What about his point, the data that exists on that?
Yeah, so a couple of points there. I mean, if you're thinking of using contact tracing and then trying to use the vaccine as a preventative for those people who have come in contact recently with someone who has COVID-19, that's not actually how this vaccine works, unfortunately. So, you know, it's not a vaccine that is going to prevent infection when someone has just had an exposure to COVID-19. So, you know, that works with some other vaccines, but that's not going to be a strategy we can use with this one.
Dr. Prinz, thanks for spending some more time with us here on the Florida Roundup. Cindy Prinz, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Florida. And Dr. Goldman, thank you for your time as well. Jason Goldman, doctor in South Florida and also the American College of Physicians liaison to the Centers for Disease Control Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Thousands of political activists, pundits, elected officials, public intellectuals are all in Orlando this week for an annual gathering of the conservative movement. The Conservative Political Action Conference, better known as CPAC, moved for the first time from its traditional home in Maryland to Florida this year. And for former President Trump and Governor DeSantis, those two are featured speakers at the event.
That's right. The governor's speaking this morning in Orlando at CPAC. Danielle Prier of WMFE in Orlando dropped in on the conservative confab, and she joins us now. Danielle, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm actually still here at CPAC. I'm sure you can hear all the people in the lobby right now. They're taking a little break in some of the speeches, and so folks are coming out to the booths and picking up material, meeting their favorite radio pundits. And so there's a lot going on out here right now.
Lots of activity. Now, let me ask you, Danielle, there's been all this discussion among the pundit class about the Republican civil war between supporters of Donald Trump and those who've criticized him or even left the GOP after the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. But we're hearing there's nothing but love for former President Trump at CPAC. Is that what you're seeing?
That is, yeah, absolutely. That's right. I mean, there's a lot of Make America Great Again hats, a lot of MAGA hats, a lot of America First hats, and even some face masks. You know, Senator Cruz took the pulpit today when he went up to make his remarks, and he just simply said that the Republican Party is still the party of Donald Trump. And I've heard that echoed speaker after speaker after speaker. And I've talked to folks who have come out here. They want to see, you know, Trump run again in 2024 without question. So they're very united around that.
Now, former President Trump is expected to declare himself the front runner for the 2024 Republican nomination when he speaks at CPAC this weekend. Governor Ron DeSantis already spoke this morning, gave a fiery speech, red meat to the conservative base. How did that play in the ballroom?
He had a standing ovation coming in and coming out, actually. He was one of the few speakers who's just had that sort of really visceral response and so much love for him from this crowd of people. You know, he really did speak about some of the issues that are near and dear to, you know, Trump supporters' hearts, including fair elections. You know, he talked about election integrity here in the state, of course, alluding to all sorts of proposed legislation to make it harder to vote by mail, which he introduced last week. Things like, you know, not allowing people outside of your own family to mail in your vote by mail ballot and not, you know, just kind of mailing out vote by mail ballots to anyone in the state, making people register every year instead of every 2 years. All of these things, which to the rest of us might sound, you know, you're making it harder for people to vote, really met with applause with this crowd today.
And in the minute or so we have left, the CPAC agenda, as you said, is focusing on themes that appeal to very conservative voters. Some Republicans, though, have cautioned that this kind of approach is what lost their party the White House and Congress. Any nod to that?
You know, I think what we've seen, if anything, is rallying around some of those agenda items. I've heard a lot about freedom of religion, freedom of speech, fair elections, gun rights. Let's see what else. Just all abortion issues, just some of the things that we've heard the last 4 years. I think we're just going to keep hearing them as vehemently as we did before. I don't really see a change from that agenda.
Any sign of Marco Rubio or Rick Scott there today?
No, not yet. But I mean, I've already run into Matt Gaetz a few times, so you never know who you might run into.
Never know.
He was actually standing next to me in the press booth.
All righty. Thank you, Danielle Pryor of WMFE in Orlando. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate you, reporting from the conference, the first time in Florida, as I mentioned, for this affair to take place.
You can see more coverage on Florida Public Radio throughout the weekend as CPAC continues. Now, still to come on the Florida Roundup here on this Friday, stick with us. The Florida-Georgia water war. It reached the nation's highest court this week. We'll talk about it next on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Media. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, a fight between neighbors made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court this week. This battle is over water. And it pits Florida against Georgia. Florida is essentially trying to convince the high court to place limits on how much water Georgia farmers can consume along the Flint River.
The water at the center of this lawsuit comes from the Apalachicola, Chattahoochee, Flint River Basin. WFSU's Rob Diaz de Villegas tells us dams in Georgia hold back the water to be used for farms there. And Florida argues not enough water is flowing into the oyster beds in Apalachicola Bay.
When it rains a lot in South Georgia, water flows freely into Florida. But when there's drought, as there was for 10 consecutive months in 2012, water stays behind the dam. And this is a source of conflict between the states.
We're not asking for a great amount of water more. We're just asking for an equal share of water.
This is oysterman Shannon Hartsfield in 2012. During the drought, the Apalachicola Bay oyster fishery had just crashed. It still hasn't recovered. In a more recent interview, Hartsfield said that he hasn't harvested oysters in nearly a decade.
I actually quit harvesting oysters in probably middle of 2012. Started working on trying to rebuild the bay. I worked and ran quite a few programs of using the oystermen rebuilding the bay.
Florida sued Georgia in 2013, claiming Georgia's water consumption caused the fishery crash.
And that's the case the Supreme Court heard this week. WFSU News Director Lynn Hatter has been following the water wars and joins us now. Hi, Lynn.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good to be with you. You know, this reminds me of the Mark Twain quote, this whole Florida-Georgia water fight, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over. This has been a long-running fight between the two states. So what's at issue? What is the Supreme Court going to decide?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court is trying to decide whether Florida should get any sort of relief. Florida wants to basically cap Georgia's water use in agriculture. But the issue is whether or not Florida actually proved that Georgia's water use is the problem. And you heard sort of Chief Justice John Roberts express some concerns about the evidence that was presented, because when the bay collapsed in 2012, that followed actually several years of drought cycles, in addition to over-harvesting of the oysters, which occurred after the 2008 BP oil spill. And so Georgia has basically said, we are not responsible for this. This is due to Florida being irresponsible with its resources. And so during oral arguments, you sort of heard this back and forth with justices trying to weigh how much harm had actually been inflicted to Florida and how much harm could be ascribed to Georgia's actions.
Yeah, I mean, Chief Justice Roberts, didn't he compare the situation to the Agatha Christie classic Murder on the Orient Express, when lots of potential culprits to the crime? He said that there could have been a lot of factors that led to the death of the Bay's oyster industry in this part of Florida. So the justices need to determine fault and responsibility, don't they, before they adjudicate how the water will flow?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. Justice Amy Coney Barrett actually asked at one point, sort of, how can you put a price on ecological damages, right? And so you hear the justices who are clearly expressing some sympathy with Florida, but again, this issue is so complicated. And there are so many factors and players in it that they seem to be having a really hard time trying to figure out what does Florida deserve. Another part of this is water management through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which directly controls water flow between Florida and Georgia with the presence of a dam that's right on the Florida-Georgia line. There have been longstanding complaints that if only the U.S. Army Corps would release more water, everything could be a lot better. And this actually came up in a previous iteration of this before a special master who told us that, Lord, I feel sorry for you, but you failed to sue the right entity. You should have been suing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Why aren't they a party to this lawsuit?
Well, they're actually a party to a second lawsuit. This is not the only lawsuit that's actually flowing through the federal system right now. There's a second lawsuit that was filed shortly after that first special master ruling that does target the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And that one is one through the Florida Wildlife Federation and the National Wildlife Federation in Florida, and another entity that has taken a fight directly to the Army Corps. When this one was filed, which was 2013, the state did not sue the Army Corps. It placed the blame solely on Georgia, and that has been part of the considerations through this kind of current iteration of this lawsuit.
Let's begin with the Florida side. What's the best case outcome for Florida in this fight?
Florida wants more water, and it is hoping that there will be a water cap on Georgia, and that cap will enable more water to flow through the dam and down into the Apalachicola Bay estuary system. That is Florida's hope. Florida wants more water. At the end of the day, people don't care really how the water gets to where it needs to be. They just want it to get there. That's Florida's best case scenario. Mm-hmm. Florida's worst case scenario is that the court says no, and things continue the way they have continued now for about 10 years. It's important to note, though, so the Bay Fishery was declared a disaster in 2013. But since then, and in these intervening years, we've gotten a lot more rainfall. There's been a lot more fresh water flowing down into the Apalachicola Bay. And things don't seem as dire as they did back in 2012 and 2013, but that does not mean that this bay is fully recovered. And I think when you talk to oystermen, fisher people on the ground, those who have studied the very delicate ecology of the system, they say, you know, Mother Nature could use a boost. And so they're hoping that a ruling will give Mother Nature the boost that it needs to finish healing itself.
Huh. We're talking about Florida and Georgia's water wars now before the U.S. Supreme Court here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Okay, so what does Georgia want out of this, Lynn? What is the state of Georgia hoping for from the Supreme Court?
Georgia is hoping not to get a water cap. We've been working with WABE, our sister station in Atlanta, and Molly Samuel actually presented the view from Georgia, talking with a South Georgia farmer, Casey Cox. And, you know, in her story, Casey talks extensively about the need for water in order to continue their family farming operation. Agriculture is big in South Georgia. It's a major, major industry. And there are a lot of farmers who rely on water from the Flint through center pivot farming to keep their crops watered and growing. And so you heard Georgia's attorney effectively argue that placing a cap on consumption would be devastating to that state's agriculture. And so they do not want a cap. They're hoping that the U.S. Supreme Court will say, you know, too bad, so sad, sorry, Florida, but we're not going to cap Georgia's water. And so Georgia obviously does not want this to happen. And so that's what they're pushing for.
Now, Lynn, this case could set an important legal precedent. Climate change is making droughts and other extreme weather events more common, especially here in the Southeast. So how significant will the high court's decision be when it comes to future water fights?
I think it could be extremely significant. Florida, Georgia, and Alabama have been fighting over this system for 30 years, but this is not the only water fight occurring between states. And so I think that's on the mind of justices, sort of what kind of precedent will this set? You heard a lot of references to a similar issue between New York and New Jersey over water sharing rights. And of course, we've all heard about what's going on sort of in the Midwest and in the western parts of the state where states are fighting over water in the Colorado. And so, you know, we're talking about a very precious, precious resource. Our river systems feed us. They feed our agriculture and they feed our ecology and the environment in which we thrive. And so how we deal with these water fights will really set a precedent for sort of how states move forward navigating these issues in the future. The resource is scarce. And I think justices recognize that. And I think if you listen to their questions, you know, their questions go beyond Florida versus Georgia, sort of some of the larger implications of this issue.
That's right. I mean, with the pandemic and the recession and everything that's been happening, these kinds of issues have been a little bit under the radar, but they're really going to reemerge full force in the next decade. People need to pay close attention to this. Lynn, we take water for granted, and we really shouldn't.
You know, water is our most precious resource. It is what keeps us alive and functioning. And the outcome of this case could have some pretty serious implications for water sharing across the U.S. I don't, and I will not say what I think the U.S. Supreme Court will do or should do, because I honestly don't know. But what I can tell you is that a lot of people have vested a lot of time and energy into this issue for a very long time. You're talking about a 30-year fight, which means that Florida, Georgia, and Alabama have been fighting over this issue for as long as I have been alive. And there's an entire generation of people who grew up knowing absolutely nothing but this fight. Casey Cox is 30 years old. Her father was fighting this fight when she was still a baby.
Thank you so much, Lynn Hatter, WFSU News Director. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
That'll do it for our program today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers.
Jason Zapka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations and Technical Director is Peter Mertz, with engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Theme music by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and supporting public radio.